You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Community radio has never been more important than here in the time of COVID, and KBOO needs your support. You can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give. There's also a donate button in the mobile app. But the very best way to support KBOO is by becoming a member at kboo.fm/give. KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. But first, a word about the places where you are. KBOO Portland is located on land that includes traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, creating communities and summer encampments to harvest and use the plentiful natural resources of the area. Portland is currently home to almost 70,000 people descended from these tribes and others. As a latecomer to this region, descended from slaves and immigrants, I thank the indigenous peoples of the Portland area for this place of refuge. I do have a guest this month, but first I'm going to read a couple of poems by Marjorie Evasco. She is a Visayan poet native to the Philippines. She was born in Tagbilaran City on the island of Bohol, and she writes poetry in English and in Cebuano Visayan. Her two books of poems, Dreamweavers and Ochre Tones, both won National Book Awards for Poetry from the Manila Critics Circle. And I'm going to read two poems by her. The first is titled Vesak 2020. The prayer flags you brought me from your month-long retreats in Nepal hang in my garden, fluttering blessings in the wind. This morning, I spied a yellow-vented warbler pecking at the frayed edges of the oldest flags, stripping the threads and carrying these up to its nesting partner. I imagined her beak receiving filaments of bright red, blue, green, and gold, weaving each into the twigs and straw, a sheltering circle of prayer fragments. On a betel palm's midrib, the nest balances, a trick of geometry winged beings know, threaded into Tarsus, throat, and song. That was Vesak 2020 by Marjorie Evasco. The second poem I'm going to read by her is titled A Turtle Poet Dreams, Given Time. Exiled from work by typhoon flash floods, she waits in her room for the whirling winds to calm down, reads her beloved poet in bed. St. Kunitz prays, "Oh, teach me to work and keep me kind." And she, swimming now among Stanley's turtles and lilies, slowly rises to the upper rim of the pond to dance with him a kind of waltz to the beat of three finger bones, dactyls swinging back to anapests, to and fro like the wet hammock in the garden. She clears her throat, hums the lauds, "Nothing here. There's nothing to have here but slow, sweet time." And that was A Turtle Poet Dreams, Given Time by Marjorie Evasco. You're listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month is Stephanie Adams Santos. She is a Guatemalan American writer and artist whose work spans poetry, prose, screenwriting, and other swampy hybrid forms. Her work is rooted in the crossroads of ritual, ancestry, and environment, always with a penchant for the weird, queer, and uncanny. She is the author of Dream of Xibalba, winner of the Horizon Books Poetry Prize, and Swarm Queen's Crown, which was a finalist for the Lambda Literary Awards, as well as Total Memory and The Sundering, which was selected for a New York Chapbook Fellowship by Poetry Society of America. Stephanie's poems and prose have appeared in a variety of publications, including Orion Magazine, Boston Review, Guernica, the anthology Speculative Fiction for Dreamers, and the forthcoming poetry anthology of Latinx Futurism's Ate Me, Until More. Stephanie also writes for television. She's written multiple episodes of Two Sentence Horror Stories, a Netflix series featuring short tales of horror and haunting. And her work has been supported by fellowships and grants, including Oregon Literary Arts, Vermont Studio Center, Film Independent, Regional Arts and Culture Council, and Oregon Arts Commission. And she is an Ohala Ignition Fellow, working on an original television pilot commissioned by UCP. In addition to her literary work, Stephanie is a professional tarot reader and occasional instructor of poetry and divination, and is currently working on a Majors Only tarot deck due for release this year. Welcome, Stephanie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So without more ado, I'd like you to read some poetry for us.
All right. I'm going to start reading from my first chapbook. It's called The Sundering. It was also kind of the first major thing that I published. And it was selected by Linda Gregg, who was one of my poetry idols and a major influence. And there was something that she wrote in the introduction that, you know, for a young poet who was still very much finding my voice, her words really anchored me and helped kind of reflect back to me what was essential about what I was doing. And I'll just quote her. She said, "The book reminds me of Theodore Retke, naked, kneeling, listening to a hole in the ground, hearing something coming back, trying to make contact with the mystery." And I, you know, as much as I'm a little bit embarrassed by the poems in this chapbook, because it's a really immature version of what my voice has become, I so appreciate that she was able to see that in these poems. And so I'm going to read a few in honor of that kind of clunky stage of my process, but also in honor of Linda, who passed away in 2019. This first one is called Obscuro Beach. The moonlight bears a form. It turns toward the terrible beginnings of the blood. A coarse reed stiffens in a girl's hair. In the waves, a light. On the shore, a torn green curtain. Yes. This is the blessed arena where it waited for you always, where the flesh parts. And the second poem I want to read from this book is called Movement. Child beneath the liquid field, your presence, ungathered, is a devastated god. The bell begins, then the rutting stags of your extraordinary thew, hauling the immense brass cannon out from the place your body fell. Later on, the slow walking. I think both of these poems for me in some way are kind of trying to look at trauma or woundedness as these sites of occult contact, or a place that becomes a portal that allows contact with something that's really powerful and beyond our understanding. And I think that, you know, that's something that carries through in my other work. So I'll read next from Swarm Queen's Crown, which was my first full-length collection of poetry. And it was a finalist for the Lambda Literary Awards for Lesbian Poetry, and that really excited me because I know I write so much about abstraction of the inner life and spirit and these parts of us that are almost beyond human. So it felt actually really deeply empowering to be recognized as a queer writer, even though my poems don't address queerness in a really direct or outward way. And I would say that most of the poems in Swarm Queen's Crown are kind of grappling with how the inner world intersects with mystic revelation and alienation, and how self-awareness and fragmentation kind of happens in those places, kind of trying to give a voice to that otherness and that experience. So the first one is called Full of Strange Experience. The hours tumble down from a geode's seam. Bits catch the light while others sink past. Shapes edge against the mind, a vast autumn of sheets sweeping down from the split. Here, experience catches like rain in a cobble rift, the life you have lived. It is November. I can hear the tearing of the crust below us, the grist bite working in its sleep. And here, another afternoon, I am sprawled over softness in a stupor of color almost in reach. It is hours after the planks have quit me. I could not walk to the next room, not now, not when the crown makes me swarm. How long have I lived beyond myself? How long have I felt but not known how the body is a labyrinth, room within room, root, ruby, hive. In this next poem, I had been reading a lot about kind of the chrysalis stage of butterflies and how I hadn't quite realized how they kind of melt and become soup. It's like they totally come apart in the chrysalis. And that intersected with this feeling of how private our transformations can be, even from our closest people. And really, we might be going through these incredibly, you know, painful, important inner moments that are completely turning us into inner soup, and people have no idea. It's a hidden process. This one's called Home Life. A caterpillar lords over sleep, a crushing larval weight. These are the hours suffered in one's own skin, turning and turning in the sack. Mama, papa, they do not hear the mute thorax tearing as I grow into another. So I'll say something really quick about the title of this poem. It's called Swarm Queen's Crown, and it came from playing Dungeons and Dragons. There's a object called the Swarm Queen's Crown. It's a magical object that, when worn, turns the user into a swarm of insects. And there was something so captivating to me about the idea of the swarm as one, of what it's like to experience yourself as many, you know, and what, you know, how many consciousnesses do we each hold in ourselves? And I love that idea of the multiplicity in the one and the fracturing of one that somehow is altogether one thing. And so that really infused this whole book, this idea of being both a whole person and a fractured person, being both a human and beyond human. And so in this poem, Insect in Order, it kind of follows the narrative of somebody who makes contact with a thing that turns them into this hive, and sort of the sacred but fragmenting experience of that. With only my pale blue instinct, I pushed aside the crate and brushed the queer circlet shoved beneath straw. The creature was awake, a lithe glint of coil, amber-eyed, wasp pupil, a crown. My hand closed on it, or was it seized and taken? My hand, now not my hand, now my hand was another's. And how did it go? I set it upon my brow then. From system to system, the eyes of one dissolve the eyes of another. I cannot recall how. I can only recall it was nothing of madness, only seemingly mad, merely the human name nudging out from its own lineage, out from its particular mammalian warmth, as a nymph nosing out from its cavity of light. Like this, it happened. It happened, a warming with the speed of wings, with our venoms poised inside, our motions with grace, such intimate acquaintance with the breeze and the wide balconies of leaves, then the soft sighs of my thousand sisters' faces, their compound eyes, which I loved in passing. Beneath the crown, I became a thousand swift masteries of another order. How many circles are inscribed in a sphere? A geometry distinctly not Euclidean. But this tells me nothing, nothing of the voice, the wet and throatless wind that troubled each magnet in us and pronounced what I cannot ever again call near. Though it was something like the air seeking each part of me out, each wing, each black arm and mouth, each rose window of my bulk, each eye, as if all of it were a single strain and toppling like waves, one roar over another, its breaching and astonishment, its song heaping upon my parts. Who touched me? That final moment in this poem, who touched me? It refers back to this biblical story where Jesus was in a crowd and a woman, a peasant on the ground recognized him and reached out and I think touched his robe. I don't remember exactly, but he immediately recognized her own, her recognition, you know, her, and there was something so mystical to me in that moment. And it just infused this whole poem, this idea of kind of this unseen but felt sacred moment, making contact with the mystery, with the divine, that's both confusing, but so clear. It like hits like a song.
You're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This is Wider Window Poetry, and my guest this month is Stephanie Adams Santos. So I wanted to diverge just for a moment. You spoke about, in this book particularly, the idea of the swarm, the fragmentation and the unity, the multiplicity. I wonder if you could relate that to your work with tarot and particularly the deck that you're now designing. I know that one of the ways to look at tarot is like each card is a different aspect of the unity that is reality.
I love that question. It's exactly how I see tarot, as, you know, these pieces, especially the major arcana, although the whole thing really, as, you know, these pieces, these archetypes that we all inhabit and that inhabit us. And they're both unique to our individuality, but also beyond us. And something I love about the tarot is that there is this idea of a linear journey. You know, the cards are numbered 1 through 22 for the major arcana. And there's this idea of the fool's journey, that the fool, you know, travels to each of the major arcana in turn and is, you know, transformed by the end. But the tarot is always shuffled and these things happen out of turn. And there's this idea that it never ends, you know, so it is this kind of wholeness that's also fragmented, and the many contained in one. And I love, you know, dreams and the unconscious, and I love the idea of the collective unconscious, that there are these larger forms that exist outside of us that we partake in. that we are fragments of, so that we ourselves are kind of fragments of larger, you know, entities. I actually, when I was younger and trying to understand different ideas of what God could be, to me, one of the most compelling ideas was like we were, you know, basically, what if we are like bacterium within the gut of this larger animal? It's like we can't comprehend the largeness or the functioning. We are fragments of this incomprehensible whole that we can't see, we can just feel into, like we're fractally connected.
And you're creating this tarot deck, you're doing both the art and kind of the interpretations, the narrative. What's unique about this deck?
This deck is really tied to the unconscious. I when I started creating the images in the fall, I let them just happen. I tried not to actually pick which card I was working on. I would just create a piece of art. And what I found were it has a lot of really unconscious imagery. It has a lot of eggs, it has a lot of eyes, it has a lot of hands, and it really blends the human and the non-human. There are no faces. There are human body parts, but they're always connected. There's like a hand coming out of a shell or an eye on an egg, you know, things like that, or an eye on a centipede's back, a human eye. And so I think it feels really animistic, and there's a lot of surreal imagery in it.
Great. This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest is Stephanie Adams Santos. I'd like you to read some more poetry for us, if you would.
I'd love to. This poem that I'm going to read next, I wrote at the confluence of two events. One was I was living in New York City, and I found a skunk in Central Park, and I thought it was dead. It was a baby, and it was covered in maggots and flies, and it wasn't moving. But just as I was passing it, I saw its little paw move, and I just couldn't walk by. And so I, you know, picked it up. I became like a mother wolf in this moment. Like I started pulling off the maggots. It's like I lost any sense of disgust. I just cared about this little baby creature. And it took 3 days to find, you know, a wildlife rehabilitator who would take the baby. And it was a really intense connection that I had with this creature. And then when I went home, I'm from Oregon, I'm born and raised in Portland, Oregon. I came home and one of the first things I saw was an opossum, and it had just recently been killed, and it was in a pool of its own blood, and it was bright red like I'd never seen. And I just felt so much respect for, you know, for the possum and also for the skunk. And I started really thinking about these creatures that we consider as pests to civilized life, you know, especially in city dwelling, raccoons, possums, skunks. And I just felt like these creatures are such survivors, and we have no idea what their inner lives are like, but I just was so moved by both of those experiences that happened in such close proximity that this poem came out of it. Of the skunk. All art is pale beside you. It too is in awe of you in trying to touch the spooked arrangement of your lying there. Were you not bathed in the syrups of all that rots? Your scent gathers me into the thicket, pulls down my face to this crest of earth, and with the sweetness of all that secret discomfort that you bear, which is yours and will never be ours, I confess in loving you, I have crawled outside of my city. And the last poem I'll read from Swarm Queen's Crown is called Saturn Returns. And Saturn Returns is the idea of, you know, there's idea that Saturn comes around to the place of our birth every 30 years. And that corresponds with these major shifts in ourselves, these major transformations that are usually pretty difficult. There's a sense of having to face yourself in a really unforgiving way, but also a powerful way. And I wrote this poem around the time I was turning 30. I did my best to cheat the windows in that plaque of ours just before my turn, seeing her round eye flit and glare through the starry knit, not star-like, but with a thick opposing absence. I remember the hammer falling in the kitchen, then my molted faces hinged back into the jams and the sunk spurs pulled away, so I was human. The injury transmuted to a faint ache in the skull. Sparks drew the table flowers down into the candles and the borders darkened. I awoke to the dining room, dressed, fed, hands occupied with mail. I awoke to myself, bereft of waking, missing the beady hour of my birth. My chores doubled and balked in domestic circuits. I sang a song to the sink. But then there comes a time when one must give herself completely to the black soaked cosmos. I stood so still in the room, emptied of spirit, for I had given it all away. It was a Tuesday. I walked heavy with its collar at my neck to the window. Like coming from a bath to the mirror, I saw this vague form of myself behind the steam and gathered heat, all spindrift and open. I could smell the brute performance of something else in the room beside me. I could feel the beginnings of her throat in my throat and her fulvous light so much like autumn, just all of it, the black slick rot of it, the whole sleet road after rain, boot soft, the breeze and crimson sheafs of it, haunching out of the fog as with a horse's bludgeoning thighs and rippling with bloom. I could do nothing but stand beside the bust of Gates and see how the air tore itself like a soft lizard's egg. For she was coming. What eyeless head and gazes of the past, all about it like a fractured bitter light, now pushed out with a beady look and smell of my own flesh, for I'd made and carried her. But then there was the privacy of stone between us, a mineral crush and heat like a slow breath circled our meeting, and I bowed, and she bowed to nothing, and was the plain ecstasy of being ever and after. I could smell the turned earth in my hands. I could smell its fur and its stink, all fire and the scent that comes. So I have a few more pieces that I'll read from my forthcoming collection, Dream of Shivalba. It's actually a single poem, a book-length poem, but told in small fragments. And Shivalba is the Mayan concept of hell, or the underworld. And for me, that's such a rich place to kind of explore. And I was thinking about kind of the reverse underworld journey. Usually it's a character visits the underworld and comes out. And in this case, I imagined a character who is actually from the underworld and who finds himself stuck in the outer world. It's really a piece about, you know, putting together the fragments of who we are and how we came to be, and looking at our own fragmented journeys, you know, and that there's a lot of pain in the book, especially pain that isn't necessarily our own, pain that comes from lineage, that comes through memory, you know, that comes from the collective unconscious, from our ancestors. So there's a lot of autobiography in this collection as well. And I'll just start with some words that I collected from my grandmother. It's not a poem. These were just words that she happened to be saying one afternoon when I was sitting with her, but it became a poem when I put them together. And so I start the collection with her words. The owl says, "Tukuru kuku, tukuru kuku." There are days when I wake up with such a sadness. Who can say why? Who can say what for? Tukuru kuku, tukuru kuku. So the owls say. At the first altar of blood, there was hardly a sound, but a trembling, something in the earth, a murmuring of teeth and mycelia, simple cries, I, I, sounds that moved like slugs in the grass of the body, leaving their traces of memory, the slow sound of the earth digesting. This is what you must listen for. The sounds that spill from the hands and burrow deep into earth, thickening in syrups, growing old and silent. Fossils do not only live in stone. The shape within you pushes outward. There beyond the torrent is the entrance to the underworld, marked by an abundance of water that asserts itself in blood. Y olor de los caites perdidos. You try to crawl inside but are too thick with supplication, too wet with the rains of your past. You are drunk. The forms behind your heart converge and flatten like a clumsy shield. You stumble past into dryness, stuck in the world, though your blood remains both here and there. Daughter of Shibalba, your eye of water is drowned, lost in its vessel of clay. Olla roja, hueco con olor de los ríos. You are banished, your heart in a mist outside of your body, ash after a fire. Flowers at your feet like pools of night. You reach into the folds as into the shadows of your reflection. The mountain stirs. La Sierra de los Cuchumatanes susurra ahí donde andan los cazadores de los loros. Here again is a mythos of blood, thoughts filling and emptying as water from a vase, green water, black water, flickering, blank. Water without reflection, water that smells of death, warm as the tears that draw trails of light from your spectral breast. Remembering, forgetting, you flare into being. You go to the window to see what time it is. Now the black grass has eaten the heads of the flowers. The amethyst of sky is dim, full of ash without origin. Before dawn, your eyes emerge. A bird there nipping at its own shadow, doubled and burnt. You loiter by the cabinet of the quetzal. Inside, the one candle burns to a nub, then mute in its dish, the tallow bears a smear of your face. There is nothing here that will tell you who you are. Outside, the water sings. Its tortuous note, devoid of the parrot, devoid of the quetzal, a song without ears, a dry silk wrapped around the throat, neither warm nor cold, but a vacillation between the two. A hammer swings through the ether of the flesh, the mind's red line. Tonight, a part of you shivers, liking it. Your whole body in one place where steel drags along. You wonder now if the body wants more to open or to shut. So that's actually part one of the book. And I could leave it at that or read more depending on whether you have questions.
You're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This is Wider Window Poetry. My guest is Stephanie Adams Santos. So your first chapbook was titled The Sundering, and this recent book you've indicated is sort of a journey towards reunification, sort of self-assembly. So do you feel like that's kind of come full circle for you?
I had never put that together, you know, this idea of the sundering or the coming apart. I feel a circling back, and you know, so much of this new work has been about recollection, and I think in the sundering, it felt so abstract. It was almost it was so surreal and abstracted from my own reality, and bringing in so much of my own life into the Shivalba, it really does feel like a spiral, like it's come back around, but now it's actually, you know, it started in the abstract and now I'm pulling in and it's becoming more whole and tangible, and pieces of my real life are more present at the surface.
And you said earlier that you're interested in sort of in trauma and wounding and injury as the spaces where there can be also contact with the uncanny or the occult, sort of liminal spaces, liminal experiences. And you write for this horror series, Two Sentence Horror Stories. Talk a little bit about that. What is that series about? Are there particular themes, and how does it work with your writing?
Yeah, just to the first part you said, you know, this idea of, you know, the site of woundedness. I think a lot about these words from Rumi: the wound is where the light comes in. And I think that applies to my interest in horror too. I think there's a lot of light to be shed when we're able to look at the darkness, especially when we can embody it, when it can be a ghost or be a monster, that, you know, there's a great opening line in one of Guillermo del Toro's films where he says, "What is a ghost but a tragedy that happens over and over and over?" So I think there is definitely a connection there in looking at these sites of woundedness. And Two Sentence Horror Stories, it's an anthology series that attempts to kind of center protagonists and story concepts that might otherwise, you know, not have made it into mainstream horror. So people of color, queer people, et cetera. And really, there's a lot of agency given to the individual writers of the episodes to kind of talk about what's important to them. So in this latest season, which is on the CW now, and will move to Netflix at the end of this month, I have three episodes, and one of them is called Plant Life. And it's about kind of how Mother Nature has a lesson for us because we haven't been able to, you know, balance our relationship with the earth and with the, you know, our kind of over reliance on tech and our disregard for nature. And it's a totally different type of writing. It's a totally different, I almost don't think of screenwriting as writing. I think of it more as an architectural thing. It's like a building, a blueprint for somebody else to carry out, and it's narrative. but there are moments, you know, they're in the crafting of moments, and I think in kind of figuring out how to talk about certain things and give them imagery, like, you know, what becomes the monster, how do I show the monster, that's where I feel like the poetry intertwines or helps give shape.
That's actually a really nice segue to the next question I was going to ask you, which is, you write poetry, you write prose, you do screenwriting, and you're a visual artist. That's a lot of different stuff. And I've talked to people before, others of my guests who write in multiple media and or do music. And one of the things I always want to know is, do you find those to be like different headspaces that don't overlap? Or do you find that they really kind of interpenetrate and inform one another?
Oh yeah, definitely the second. I think they all, it's like a hydra, you know, and they, or chimera, it's like all the heads have one body, and they overlap so much that sometimes I unconsciously will use the same words in a poem, in a script, or all the same story, you know, the same concept. They'll kind of cross over very unconsciously, and that it's great though, because some things can only be expressed as poetry, and some things really are more suitable for like a narrative or story. And for visual art, I love just taking my head out of the equation and letting it be more of an unconscious, not a thought-based process, but just more of the hand and of the moment. And so it really, I think the more mediums I have, the more I feel like I can wholly express certain things.
So tell me a little bit about your education. Where did you go to school? Did you have any teachers who were really strong influences on you?
Oh yes. So I grew up in Portland, and I went to Chapman Elementary School and Lincoln High School, and they were great art teachers at Lincoln. My ceramics teacher, I really loved, and she really encouraged me to just make whatever I wanted to. And I made really dark things, you know, I think I had a lot to express, and I made almost like nightmarish sculptures. And in my experience, adults seem to always be afraid of darkness or kind of look at it as something you should not do. Whereas she really opened up this world for me that it was okay to express these things. And I think that was a huge part of my development. And also my English teachers, especially Christine Jenkins, who herself had an MFA in poetry. And she was kind of the first person who really said, hey, you have a knack for writing, you should keep doing it. And I think everybody who is an artist in some form had somebody in their life open that door for them in that way. It's so hard to see yourself. And so if somebody doesn't open that door for you, it's so much harder. And Christine was amazing, and she introduced me to incredible literature and lots of poetry, and she invited poets to the class, and that was definitely what opened that whole world for me. And then beyond high school, I ended up I'm the first generation in college in my family, and so college was a bit of a foreign concept for me. It wasn't something we talked about. It wasn't something that was necessarily just assumed. And it wasn't until a counselor at school looked at my grades and my interests and was like, let's apply to college and let me help you pick where to apply. And so I got into Stanford and on a full scholarship. And that's where I met Gabby Calvacrezzi, who's a poet who fully, you know, pulled me away from biology, which was kind of the route I was going down, and pulled me to the world of poetry. I also was in the Film Society and got into film in that world in college. And it was Gabby who also said, you should do an MFA in poetry. And I remember going home after that and looking up what MFA meant. So it was, I always felt like an alien in both at Stanford and at Columbia where I got my MFA. I felt like a, you know, imposter syndrome and also kind of like an alien visitor, like what are these institutions and places? But I met such interesting people and was so lucky to be able to experience those, you know, experience those things, even if they were hard.
Don't you think that makes for good poetry, though, that sense of alienation and, like, what is it all about, really? You have to keep asking yourself.
Yeah. I think, too, after college, I feel like I had to start over because there's so much conformity in how people are shaped sometimes in institutions. And I think coming back out and really, you know, actually embracing the alien of it all. Because I think when I was in those situations, I was trying to erase that part of myself and conform and, you know, talk like the people whose parents had PhDs and they had all of these words and references and pop culture. And I felt like I needed to be that. And then coming out of it, I did a lot of, you know, unbuilding to kind of find myself fresh, you know, outside of those systems.
So that was where you went back into the chrysalis and turned yourself back into soup?
Yes, exactly. And my chrysalis happened to be in a random city in Massachusetts. I didn't have a car. I didn't have access to driving. And I was just in the middle of nowhere. And I was in this house with another poet for 3 years. And we just were like hermits. And it was a very kind of inward time. And I did completely come apart and back together in that time. And still am in that process.
This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. My guest this month is Stephanie Adams Santos. We have about 10 minutes left. I'd like to hear a few more poems, if you would, and then I'm going to close by asking you a completely random question.
Ooh, okay. I'm going to go back into Dream of Shibalba. Start us with part two. Ch-ch-ch. The hens tear open the earth with their sun-colored hands. Wake up. There are rumors about you. The strangers pass amongst themselves. They don't know. They don't know pain is a flower that blooms in the eye. Unable to sleep, you stare adrift from your house of nerves. You are the gossamer prismer spun into the shape of what you see. Between your eyes and the ceiling, a recollection comes, angular, without pattern, like a headache hanging in air. Scent of nose blood and damp ash, a crystal shattered in stone. Perfume of the underworld, homeward as a hammer's head. A psychic weight tumbles in the shade of the magnolia. Two eyes are buried, two stones at your feet. Here you stand in the infinite dreaming of the dead. Objects shed their illusions. The bottle of rum, the bottle of whiskey, now both are folded into blood. A note in your grandmother's hand passes to yours, blank, deep red. You're trying to remember something, the fearful neutrality of a rose without moisture. You can't explain it to anyone, but in the back of your mind, a brown rose hangs upside down, swinging above you in the past without a shadow. Kukulkan sleeps, steeped in earth, a black root thickening with spice. Why should you lie? It's not God you're thinking of. You lean to touch your wife who isn't there. Your tongue becomes foam, and morning makes a paste of your eyes on the metate stone. Tendrils propagate from your bones, searching for something to cling to. If you could only pray the right way, you might reach the secret sleep of the Creator where the roses engulf you. If you had the right words, you could taste the whole earth with this vacant tongue. It's as though you are walking alone in a garden. Out of the sky, the star cuts you. You hear the crush of flowers, a sharp cry, the obsecration of a stem. The blood in your body has lost and turned to water. You pertain to your sorrow. You are invented by its blows. Far away, a single rose swells on the vine. The old thing humming, just freshly born, blue shadows absolute. Can a shape look like a cry? Can joy erupt from a thorn? You are netted by ghosts, O shadowy ants of Shinabahul, who talk beneath ruins, O basket-headed women of Huehuetenango, who fill the graveyard ovens with bread, the white earth mouths of the ovens, the blue-tongued heat hisses silently at their hands. You walk at night to the stone court of Zakuleu, dreaming of the stone ball falling that obliterates the nerves. You climb the temple stairs, climb arduously toward death. Off the wet edge of obsidian, your head tumbles down the arc of a serpent's back, singing. Stone that swallows blood, O temple, catch me, catch me. You want to know where you come from. Aquí la noche da vueltas lentas, un sopilote negro e inmenso. The night circles you with its many eyes of fire. Below you, the ground is a vast accumulation. You scry into an emptiness where everything blinks back. A thousand bodies of memory buzzing through darkness, a great swarm that descends, eating the violets, the lilies, the aguacates. All reflections are consumed. The eclipse cuts even your shadow. You are the lost daughter of Xibalba. Can't you see the Sith swinging from your footsteps? A thousand deaths in every direction. Should I read one more?
One more.
Beneath you, amethyst caves vibrate and groan the earth's emptiness. Mushrooms of pleasure molt into dark cupolas. Now a shade falls over you, a chittering, infinitesimal spirits too slight for understanding. You open yourself, your mouth, your eyes, your forehead with a sharp stone carried from childhood.
Okay, here is your completely random question. If you could see one historical event, you don't get to change it, you just get to see exactly what happened. What would you choose and why?
Oh, one historical event. There are a couple ways I could go with that. Part of me, is so curious about my mom's lineage pre-colonization in Guatemala. My grandma comes from Mom Heritage, which was the Mayan group from the area where she's from. And there's just no records, you know? And so it's not necessarily historical in the large sense, but I would be so curious to meet those people and to see their rituals. The other answer I had was the moment, you know, the idea that something came out of the sea and became humans, or, you know, gradually became a mammal or, you know, walked on land, that moment, I would love to see the first, you know, that first instant, even if it's microscopic, you know, the cell transforming. There's something about that kind of, you know, the transferring of something that's completely oceanic and cellular becoming an organism. That's, you know, that's so fascinating to me.
You've been listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month was Stephanie Adams Santos. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us. I had a wonderful time. I hope you did too.
Thank you so much, Jill. You have the best questions.
And to all my listeners out there, stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll talk to you again next month. We'll be right back.
KBOO Portland.
Hey there, it is 11 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. My name is Gary. I'm going to sit with you for an hour and play you some funnies. I hope you don't mind. Shall we begin? Perhaps I should turn the channel on first. It's beginning in the worst possible way, but it will get better.
I'm so hungry. What's good to eat here at the Kentucky Fried Chicken, man? What do you have on the menu that's good? Oh, our mashed potatoes are awesome. All right, I'll say that right now.